My name's Tammy, I'm an alcoholic. My name is not Cammy. But I said that I was gonna get up and say my name was Cammy, and I was born and raised in New York City, and see if y'all would believe me. I'm always really nervous when I speak. Before I get started, I just wanna thank Milton for inviting me. I want to thank Judy for coming with me. It's always a lot more fun when you have someone that comes. God, there's so many old-timers here. I love old-timers. It's so good to see so many. I'm proud to say in Montgomery, as far as I know, and Box 459 did an article, we have the oldest living sober member in Alcoholics Anonymous, and he will be celebrating 60 years of sobriety. And Box 459 did an article on him, Easy E. Some of you may know him. But and he still goes to meetings, you know, and that's what's so good, is to see the old timers still coming to meetings. A lot of them don't come in Montgomery, you know, and we need y'all to come, you know. We need you to come and to guide us and teach us. You don't want to just leave it up to us to figure this out. You know, we will really screw it up, I promise you. My sobriety date is July the 16th, 1991, and for that I am so grateful. They have me speak tonight because I'm the baby in the program, and so if I mess everything up, Dick and Henry can fix everything, you know, tomorrow night and Sunday. My home group is a primary purpose group in Montgomery, and it is the best group in the United States, at least, I know. And my sponsor tells me, if you don't think that about your home group, you need to find another one. And I believe her. Does it ever quit raining here in Monteagle? Judy and I came in late last night, and we could not see 2 feet in front of us coming up the mountain. And I was driving, and I mean, like 15 miles an hour on Interstate 24, and Judy kept going, and I said, Judy, are you okay? I think she was about to faint over there because, I mean, really, we could not see. And then today we go off, and we're going to sightsee and just take a ride, and Judy has the map. And I should know better than an alcoholic with a map, and, you know, she had us, I mean, we have been, I couldn't even tell you where we've been, to be honest. We have drove and drove, and, you know, it was like I was looking for Butcher Holler or something like that. I mean, we went Highway 108 for hours and hours, and, I mean, we were, like, really visiting mountain folk up in there. And so we did find our way back, and I will never give Judy another map, ever. It's good to be here. Like I said, I get real nervous when I speak, and I'll tell you, the first experience I had speaking, they took us out from an institution, and there was four of us, and they said we all had to speak 10 minutes. And I would have sang a song if they wanted me to get out of this institution. So I was a nervous wreck, and I was shaking all over, and I got up to the podium, and I got the fiddling with it, and it had shelves, and I put my foot up here, and the whole thing went rolling out. It had wheels on it, you know. And I was at a group in Wetumpka, Alabama, and there was a lot of old-timers there, and they were just all looking at me like, what the hell is she doing at our podium, you know? So I've had some experiences. I was speaking in another group later on in Selma, Alabama, and it was in an old building, and the building was about to fall down, and I went in the bathroom to pray, and I put my purse on the sink, and the whole sink came off the wall. So I'm a nervous wreck. I just get sick before I have to speak. So I pushed the sink back up, and I went and sat down, and like 30 seconds later, the door went boom, and water spraying out of the bathroom. And I was like, Lord, what happened? And I didn't tell them that I did that. And so I'm looking, I always check out the get up here, and everything looks pretty secure, but I'm thinking, We are in a church. You know, I cannot believe I'm speaking like in a church with all these crosses and everything. So I hope the roof don't cave in or anything. Anyway, I'm supposed to tell you in a general way what I was like and what happened to me and what it's like today. And I was born in Montgomery, and I have one brother. And I talk a little bit about my childhood, not much, but, you know, my dad, he shot pool for a living. That's what he did. He was a pool hustler. Sold a little drugs on the side, rode a Harley. You know, he left when I was 3 years old. So I guess you could say growing up, I wasn't from the Leave It to Beaver family, okay? And my mom did the best she could raising us. She really did. And I used to try to figure out what happened. Why did I turn out to be an alcoholic? And there's an old timer in our group, and he used to always say, you know, it really don't matter how the jackass got in the ditch. How are you going to get him out? And, you know, that's the way I feel about it. I don't know if my mama dropped me on my head when I was a baby. I don't know what happened. I do know this. When I drink, I can't act right. I know that much. So anyway, that was my childhood coming up, me and my brother. My mom worked two jobs, tried to get us out of the projects and move us to a better side of town. And she did the best she could. She really did. But growing up, and I hear a lot of speakers say this, I always felt different. I never fit in. I didn't fit in with the cool kids. I didn't fit in with the smart kids. I didn't fit in with sports. I just didn't fit in. It was like I just didn't fit in the skin. And it was like that for me until I was 12 years old and I took my first drink of alcohol. Now, I don't remember a lot about my childhood, but I remember the night I took my first drink. Me and my best friend, we lived in the projects, and I lived upstairs, she lived downstairs, and we went out and we got drunk on Red Malt Up, because that was the thing back then. And I can remember when I drank that red wine and when it went down, and after that short period of time when that effect took place, it was like a magical potion. And I remember that night, and I remember I had the best time of my life. I fit in. I was as pretty as funny as. I could dance on the car, do whatever you wanted to. And I remember that magic. I remember it. Now, I got in trouble the first time I drank, and I got in a lot of trouble after that. Me and my friend and I, we made it home. I made it in my room. The bed was spinning, I was about to throw up, but my mom didn't catch me. Well, she goes home, she lives right downstairs from me, and she starts throwing up. So she's in there throwing up. Her mother comes in there, she's 11 years old now, we should be playing with Barbies, you know. She's throwing up and her mother says, well, honey, did you drink some red Kool-Aid or have you been eating red candy? And she's like, no. Her mother rushed her to the emergency room, thought she was hemorrhaging, throwing up blood. So the doctor comes out laughing and says, there's nothing wrong with this kid, but she's drunk on red wine. Her mother called my mother, and my mother beat me to death, put me on restriction for 5 years or whatever. But you know what? It didn't matter. Because they talk about that line you cross into alcoholism, and I can tell you that for me, I feel like I crossed it that night. Because I had found an answer. I had found a magical potion. And all those consequences didn't matter. Now, I couldn't drink every day. I wasn't but 12 years old. But if I wasn't drinking, I was thinking about it. And I was waiting until the next time I could. And from that point, it just went downhill for me. And it went downhill pretty quick. Other things, I started doing other things, and drugs are part of my story. I don't talk about them a lot from the podium, but you know, and a lot of old timers will just cringe up, but you know, this is what I say. If you were born after 1940 and you didn't at least smoke a joint, where were you? You know, I mean, that's just what we did. And I can sum up my whole little drug story or whatever you want to call it like this. My Uncle Clarence was a wino. And he was a wino that we view alcoholics, you know, when we're trying to be in the denial. And he was a wino that drank under the bridge, drank his wine in a paper bag. He'd stay under the bridge all month. He got a check the first of the month. He'd come home. We'd rob him. He'd go back under the bridge. I mean, this is every month. And one night, Clarence was there, and I'd been out all night. Now, I'm not but probably 15, 16 years old. I'd been out all night, and I woke up sick. And I said, Clarence, give me a drink of that wine. And I took a big old drink of that wine. It was Wild Irish Rose. And I spit it out, and I said, damn, Clarence, you ain't nothing but a wino. And that man looked at me with all the disgust you can imagine, and he said, well, at least I'm not a any-o. You'll do any damn thing. And he was right. He summed me up. That's what I was. I was an any-o. I would drink Crown Royal or Mad Dog 2020. If we were in a bar and you handed me a handful of pills, I would just take them. It could be X-Lax or anything, you know? And he summed me up that day at that early age. I was an any-o, and that's what I was. So this is the way, when I was in the eighth grade, I quit school, started going in and out of detention centers. My knight in shining armor rode up. He was a drugstore robber, and man, life really meant something then, you know? And so we went off into the sunset, and boy, I tell you what, you know, in and out of detention centers, and this is the way it started downhill. Everything my mom had worked for, trying to work two jobs and trying to do whatever she could to make it right for me and my brother, just thrown out the window. And this is where it just starts going downhill. By the time I was 18, I had my first felony, because when you're living on the streets, because my knight in shining armor, of course, When you rob drugstores, chances are you're going to get caught eventually. And he did in Mississippi, and he went to Parchman for 40 years. And there I was, 18 years old, out there on the streets. And I'll tell you, I did a lot of things I'm not proud of. Because every day when I open my eyes, it's where am I going to get that next drink? Who am I going to rob, steal, con, manipulate, whatever I had to do to get the next drink? I heard a speaker say one time, and it's really true the way my life was at about this point in my life. He said, every morning when I woke up, and this was true for me too, and I threw my hand off the bed, if it was carpet, it was going to be a good day. And if it was concrete, it was going to be a bad day, you know? And that's pretty much what my life was summed up at 18 years old. And that is so sad. Got my first felony when I was 18, stood in front of a judge, and he said some things to me that were beyond my comprehension. He said, get a job. Go to work, go to school, do something. So I left that day, and he gave me a 10-year suspended sentence, 5 years probation. And I, like most of us in here, I needed a drink after all that. And I stopped and got me a drink. And I don't know about you, but I didn't do probation well drinking. I didn't never show up to report. You're supposed to do that. And so what I did was I got this keen alcoholic mind kicking and thinking, figuring it out. What's the problem? I figured out what the problem was. Montgomery, Alabama was my problem. There's more police there than there are people. And they're always picking on me. Keen alcoholic mind. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to move to Dallas, Texas, and life's going to be great. So I did. I moved to Dallas, Texas. Got a job on Harry Hines Boulevard. It's right where you need to be if you're a good old drunk like me. And what I figured out is what you told me in AA, is everywhere I go, there I am. And you know what? They sell alcohol in Texas. And they got a lot of other stuff in Texas. And so there I was in Texas. I stayed on the run for a couple years. And, you know, you get tired out there on the run. You get tired. And I did what most good alcoholics do. called Mommy, you know. Called Mom, came back to Alabama, and when I was 21 years old, I stood back in front of that judge, and he gave me a 10-year sentence in state penitentiary. 21 years old. Now, I'm laying in that county jail, and I'm scared, because the only thing I know about prison is what I've seen on TV. I said, I'm going to go in there. They're going to slap me down, take my stuff. I mean, all my stuff. You know what I mean? And I'm scared. And I laid in there and I said that jailhouse prayer that many of us know so well. God, if you'll just get me out of this one, I promise. Well, the doors didn't swing open and I said, see, there's no God. So I made my first trip to Judah Tutwiler Prison. That's the only women's prison in Alabama. And I can remember going through that back gate. And you know, the book talks about that pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization. And how many times us alcoholics experience it over and over and over. And I could stand up here all night and tell you many, many times that pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization. And this was one of those times. You walked in the back gate of that prison, they stripped you down, they sprayed you like an animal, and for the next 2.5 years, that's how I lived, like an animal. Because that's how you live in prison. But you know, the alcoholic ego, you know, will pop back really quick. And that old keen alcoholic mind got to kicking around, sitting in that penitentiary after a couple weeks, figuring out what the problem was. And I said, I know what the problem is. When I get out, I mean, I am through with all that dope. I am through with it. And it's going to be drinking only. And I might smoke a little weed, but I probably won't. It's drinking only. Now, for 2.5 years, I sat in that prison. And I had like this little cartoon vision in my head of me. I could see myself, White House, picket fence, sipping a little champagne or wine coolers. And I mean, dogs, kids, cars. I mean, it was beautiful. And you could have came in that prison with your big book and you could have said, Tammy, but if you take one drink, and you could have told me everything in this book. But you know, the baffling part about alcoholism is that I lived in that delusion that somehow, someday, I'm going to be able to drink like normal people. Somehow, someday. 2.5 years, beautiful picture, White House, picket fence. They let me out. Like most of us in here, after all that, I needed a drink. I stopped at not even 2 blocks from that prison on Highway 231 in Wetumpka, Alabama. Went in and got me a 6-pack. Drank that first Budweiser. Just like a Tasmanian devil. Till they locked me up again. See, the hardest thing for me ever to admit to myself was that I was an alcoholic. I would tell you anything else. I'd tell you I'm a drug addict because that sounds pretty cool. I'd tell you I was a schizophrenic if you want me to tell you that. But I'm not an alcoholic. Clarence, my Uncle Clarence is an alcoholic. Look at him. And why that was so hard for me to admit, I don't know. Because this is how I drank. I drank at a bar called the Honey for the Bears. Okay, that give you an idea picture, Honey for the Bears. You can just get you a vivid picture of it. It never closed. Stayed open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And for people like me that don't work, don't have a house, don't have a car, it's perfect. Because you could just stay there for days. And you could just drink till you couldn't hold your head up no more. And then you could just go over in a booth and fall out. Sleep it off for a while, come to, and I'd just be whooshing my hair back. Buy me a drink, baby. You know, steadily looking for Miltons to come in there, like vultures, you know? Just praying on like a vulture waiting on them to come in. Good drunks that drank like you, you know? Buy me a drink, baby. And just stay there for 3, 4, 5 days. Wouldn't bathe. Have black feet, because, you know, when you're a drunk like me, if you get shoes, you sell them. So I wore flip-flops. I wore flip-flops in the summer, flip-flops with socks in the winter. So I'd just be down there and just, I mean, this gives you a picture. When I got sober, I watched that movie Barfly, and it just almost made me sick to my stomach, because that was me. That was me. If you hadn't seen that movie, watch it. And there's my story, my drinking story. So this is how I drank. It's like a Tasmanian devil back at Ineo. I mean, just living in abandoned cars, on the streets, panhandling, whatever, stealing, robbing. I mean, just whatever I had to do to get the next drink. Until they locked me up again. Got a new case, went back in front of that judge, got a new 10-year sentence, went back to that prison with 20 years in the state penitentiary, 2 10-year sentences running consecutive. Now I'm sitting in the receiving unit, and this keen alcoholic mind, I'm thinking, what went wrong with the White House picket fence program, you know? I said, I know what it was. I shouldn't have never drank that hard liquor. I know that Canadian whiskey makes me crazy. I shouldn't have never drank it. And when I get out this time, it is beer only. I mean beer only, nothing else. And you could have came in there with your big book and you could have said, da-da-da-da-da. But see, the baffling part was the delusion that somehow, someday, I'm going to be able to drink like other people. Stayed in that prison a year and a half. I mean, just you couldn't have told me any different. They let me out. My mom picked me up. I stopped at the same convenience store, 2 blocks from the prison, got a 6-pack, drank that first beer, and was like a Tasmanian devil until they locked me up again. Luckily, when I went back for my 3rd trip to that prison, I didn't have a new felony. I just went back for a parole violation. And by this time, they had the handy-dandy treatment centers and corrections. Now, I don't know about Tennessee, but when I speak in Alabama, I always like to tell the newcomers that, you know, if you don't get it here, Department of Corrections got a bed for you. They're going to give you treatment. Free treatment, long treatment, 18 months worth of treatment. So if you don't get it here, Department of Corrections is going to give you treatment in the state of Alabama. They got whole prisons that are nothing but treatment centers. Whole prisons, 4 or 5 of them in the state. So when I went back for this 3rd time, they had the handy-dandy treatment center. You're not going to believe this, but the intake officer recommended I need treatment. I was so mad. I don't know what my plan was going to be this time. Probably light beer only. I don't know. But you can believe I had a plan. Because, see, I couldn't imagine life without alcohol. I couldn't imagine life without it. Went through that treatment. Heard a lot of things. Graduated with honors. Julia Tutwiler Prison Wings Program. Heard a lot of things. A lot of things happened for me in that treatment. But I still had too many yeah buts. You know, the counselor would say, Tammy, you got to go to meetings. And I'll go to meetings, but I'm not going to meetings every night. I got a life. I mean, I really got a life. You know what I mean? And she said, you need to be in a meeting the first night. I said, I'll go to meetings, but I got something to do that first night I get out, and it ain't at a meeting. Kind of like our newlyweds, wherever they're at. And she said, you got to get a sponsor. And I said, I'll get a sponsor, but she's had to been to prison at least twice. And everything they said, yeah, but. But a lot of things happened. Speakers would come up there. And one of the speakers one night, my counselor told me to meet her at the front gate. And I walked up to the front gate, and it was the girl I took my first drink with. Her name is Della. And she came in there, and she told her goofy little story, and her little eyes were twinkling. And I thought, man, I've been locked up too long. They got some good stuff going on out there. Because I didn't know she was sober. I mean, she was telling us she was sober, but I didn't believe anybody could live sober. I mean, I just couldn't comprehend that. So I thought that gleam in her eye was a new drug I hadn't experienced or something. And she told her little story, and I always like to say this, and she's my sponsor today. But a lot of people say they don't go in the jails and they don't go into corrections and carry the message because they've never been to jail and they don't have anything to share. Well, I want you to know that this lady had never been to jail and she had never been to prison. And she carried the message to me and she planted a seed for me. If you ever get the opportunity to go to the prisons or the jails, go. You never know who you're going to see. You know those shady characters we were hanging out with out there. I'm sure you're going to know somebody in there. So anyway, I heard a lot of good things, and I always like to share this too. That I mean, speakers came in, and this guy named Joe S., and he's a good friend of mine today. He's been sober, I think, 16, 17 years. And he had long hair, and he rode his Harley and had leathers on and came in there to speak to our dorm. And I thought, there's no way you're sober and ride a Harley, You know, because I couldn't comprehend people being sober and living on the streets and being sober. But anyway, the speakers, after every speaker, we got asked questions. And I always sat on the back row on my throne of contempt because I was so cool, you know, I was cool. And I'd always ask the same question to every speaker that came in there with an attitude. Just what do you do for fun? As every speaker that came in, just like that, what do you do for fun? Because see, I'm sitting in there, I'm feeling sorry for those AA people. What a boring, dull life they have. I'm feeling sorry for them. They're leaving, going home. So I asked Joe that question, and usually they'd start trying to explain it to me. And they try so hard to help me. You know, they wanted me to get it so bad. And they'd say, well, we go to meetings, and we go to Shoney's, and we go bowling, and and they just try, and they try to tell me what they do for fun. And I'm sitting back there like, you know, should I blow my brains out, or can I have this much fun, you know? And oh, Joe, that night I asked him the same question, just what do you do for fun? And he looked back there at me and he said, I tell you this, honey, I guarantee you I'm having a hell of a lot more fun than you having sitting in this penitentiary. And you know, it was a good lesson for me because I learned then, you're wasting your air trying to tell a newcomer what we do for fun. Think about it. And so if they asked me today, I say, you know what? Just stick around one day, going to jail, waking up with hangovers, making your mama cry, making your kids cry, living on the streets. One day, all that stuff's not going to be fun, but it's going to take time. Just keep coming around. But anyway, Joe, I learned a really powerful lesson from him, and I never asked that question anymore either. So anyway, I got out, and didn't go to a meeting the first day. Was drunk within 24 hours. And y'all were all sitting there like, oh, God, I can't go back to prison again. Think of how I felt. You think you're tired. I was tired. I was drunk within 24 hours. Within 5 months, I was in my parole officer's office, and he said, you're going back, Tammy. Now, this is where I know that God did for me what I couldn't do for myself. Because this was the meanest parole officer I'd ever had. His name was Paul Bush. He wore a hearing aid, and he turned it up and down and up and down. And he told me I was going back, and I said, look, please don't send me back to that prison. I said, I know what I should have done. I just didn't do it. Just please give me a chance. He said, I'll give you 48 hours to get yourself somewhere. God doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. So I did. I called my counselor, and I went to a place in Sylacauga and a place called Carradale. And this is what happened to me as I remember it. I was sitting in a field, and I was looking out. It's a beautiful place, and I was looking out over this field. And I just started crying, and I couldn't stop crying. And I reached out and asked this God that I did not understand with everything in me, I said, you know, God, if I can't stay sober and stay on these streets, then please give me the courage to end it all right now. Or help me, because I cannot go on like this. That, as I remember it, after that, I like to say I had a spiritual experience. It wasn't a burning bush and it wasn't a bolt of lightning. But the next thought that came to my mind was, you know, AA is about the last house on the block for you. And AA can't be as bad as the way you're living now. Now, I know that don't sound real spiritual to y'all. But if you would have asked me the day before that about AA, I would have said, man, AA is all right, you know, it's a bunch of old men, you know, they sit around and talk about fishing, drink that coffee. They're too old to drink. When I get that old, I'll quit too, you know. They go bowling, they go to Shoney's. I'm a gangster. I can't live like that, you know. That's what I would have told you the day before that. You know, the book talks about, and I think it was Dr. Young that was saying that, was the doctor, and he says that sometimes we have vital spiritual experiences. It's like that emotional rearrangement where one set of ideas and attitudes and emotions that were the guiding forces of our life are somehow taken over by a new set of attitudes, emotions, and ideas. As I remember it, that's what happened that day. Because, you know, I went through detox there, and when I got out, I did just what I'd always heard to do. I went to a meeting the first day. I went to a meeting every day. You know, and I'll always be so grateful to Alcoholics Anonymous for loving me unconditionally, for accepting me just the way I was when I got to you. You know, I was pretty sick. Most of us are. I was a legend in my own mind. I was borderline institutionalized. I carried a switchblade this long, key chains, the whole, just vision it, brogans, no makeup, cut off shirts, dapping around those meetings. I'd be in there and I'd get mad at the old timers and I'd be in there going, I'll carve my initials in their head. Now, can you imagine putting up with that in your home group? And they would just say, keep coming back. Just keep coming back. And at one time I thought they were being nice, and it took me a while to realize they were really being smart. That was a smart remark. So then I got where they'd say, just keep coming back. You know how you tell them real sick ones, just keep coming back. Then I'd want to fight them. I'd say, no, you keep coming back. I mean, wanting to fight them in the meeting. Think about it. And you know, when I think back of getting sober, and it's like the language, and if you don't know it, and I'd be in there and they say things like, the first drink gets you drunk. And I went, what in the hell was y'all drinking? You know, I mean, I just didn't get it. I thought they had some powerful moonshine or something that I hadn't tried, you know. And there was this old timer used to always say, because I was fairly young when I got sober, I was 29, and he'd always say, I spilt more on my tie than you ever drank. And I said, well, you ought not to spill so much. You might have got here sooner with your old self, you know. And just all that when you think back of, you know, of all the things when you first sober up. You know, I was sick. I was really was. And, I mean, I had trouble getting a sponsor. I mean, they weren't like lined up out the door wanting to sponsor me and my switchblade, you know. And I always laugh because my group kind of measured my sobriety and serenity by my knife size going down. And it is kind of embarrassing thinking back on it today, you know. But yes, I will always be grateful for AA loving me unconditionally. You know, you talk about the Al-Anons, and I don't know why I didn't like AA women when I got sober. I don't know what it was. I just did not like them. But I loved the Al-Anons. I loved them. And they taught me a lot about living life, because I was socially retarded. I'll be the first to admit I was a tad bit socially retarded. And I would go up there and I would see what they wore, the clothes they wore, and I'd go try to buy clothes like that because I didn't know how to dress. You know, I'd see them make cakes and stuff like that, and I'd see everybody eat those cakes and be, oh, this is so good. I didn't know how to cook, but I did know how to mix those cake mixes. So I started making cakes at my group and everybody'd eat them, you know. And so I love Al-Anon. Today I like some of the women in AA, not all of them. But I do love Al-Anon. And I don't know, you know, a lot of people say that's unusual when you sober up. But I love the Al-Anon women, and they were the only ones I would talk to. And it would seem like I'd be talking some of them old drunk alcoholic women, but I just didn't like them. But anyway, I did get a sponsor. I finally got this one lady that took me on, a little lady about this tall. She had problems other than alcoholism, evidently, if she's going to sponsor me and my switchblade. So anyway, I'll always be so grateful to her because she taught me so much about the home group and love in Alcoholics Anonymous and service in Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, I used to call her up. And you know how we are when we're new. We have a problem a minute, you know. Wah, 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 wah. And so I'd call her up on the phone and I'd say, well, whatever it was. And she'd say, okay, meet me at the group. I'd say, all right, she's going to give me the $50 or whatever it was I needed, you know. And I'd get over the group, and she'd hand me the Comet and the toilet scrubber. And I'd be back there scrubbing that AA toilet thinking, does she know who I am, you know? But I wouldn't drink that day. So when I think about the steps, you know, alcohol had to beat me into a state of reasonableness. It had to beat me until I had no other ideas of a way to drink. And when I think about step two, I think about that little lady. And I think about scrubbing those toilets when I didn't have a clue what that had to do with staying sober. But I wouldn't drink that day. And she would tell me to go to a meeting every day. Well, I didn't think I needed a meeting every day. Come on. But I would do it because she told me to do it. And I wasn't drinking. So when I think of step two and coming to believe in some power greater than me and my thinking, I think about the power of suggestion of this little lady who was telling me all these things. She said, pray in the morning and pray at night. You know, I didn't really believe. I don't know if I was atheist, agnostic, or just didn't care anymore. She told me to pray. I did it. Started staying sober, you know, and we started working the steps. And when I think of the third step, and when I made that decision to turn my will and life over to God as I understood God, I got on my knees with a sponsor and I said a prayer. And, you know, I didn't feel anything but a little silly praying with another person. I mean, you know, this big gangster convict having to get down on my knees and pray with somebody. And it's only looking back now that I see how the power of God started working in my life. You know, before I speak, I always just kind of open my book and say, where are we going tonight, God? And this is what I read tonight. And this reminds me of step three in my life. And it's, we in our turn sought the same escape with all the desperation of drowning men. What seemed at first a flimsy reed has proved to be the loving and powerful hand of God. A new life has been given us, if you prefer a design for living that really works. And that's what it felt like at that point, a flimsy reed. And I didn't realize the power that started working in my life. And so many things started changing. I always like to talk about working the fourth and fifth step because for me, this is just my experience and experience of sponsoring people and watching them. You put so much energy into dreading doing that fourth step. Oh, just the build up and the build up of doing the fourth and then the fifth step. And of course for me, because I'm a gangster, you know, I'm so tough and got so much. When I did my fifth step with my sponsor, and she was prim and proper, been sober 20-something at that time, my sponsor, 20-something years, and she started telling me some of the things she did. I was like, oh, my God. Yeah, I just couldn't believe she had done some of that. But anyway, the big build-up to the fourth and fifth step. And so I finally did it, and it just really wasn't, you know, it just wasn't all that. This is my experience. After I did that step and all that energy I put into it, I just quit working the steps. She told me to go get quiet for an hour, but I didn't feel like it. I was tired after doing the fifth step. I didn't work no more steps. I didn't make any amends. And the result of that, after about a year, and I truly believe the saying, there's no standing still in this program, you're either moving forward, even if it's just a baby steps at a time, or you're moving backwards. I believe that today because I wasn't working any steps. I was just going to a lot of meetings, and meetings are great, but they don't get you spiritually fit, you know, without doing some other things. And I started getting sicker and sicker. And the result of that, after I think I had a couple years, 2.5 years sobriety, I found myself rolling around fighting another AA woman in the AA parking lot. Now, that don't do much for your spiritual image in Alcoholics Anonymous, okay? And she signed a warrant on me, and I don't blame her, and that didn't do much for my parole program. Now, I was on parole for 20 years, you know, and he's like, Tammy, you cannot be beating people up at AA, you know? I mean, what do I need to stop you from going to AA? But I can tell you it was the biggest turning point. And today, me and this lady are friends. I mean, she don't want to hang out with me or nothing, but we made amends and we're friends. It was the biggest turning point in my sobriety. It was this close to drinking. Because see, instead of walking around like, whatever, I felt so bad. Because that was that old Tammy. I was going backwards. And I was so close to drinking. Divine intervention, the grace of God. Instead of taking that drink, because I'm going to tell you, I got in so much pain, I had to have some relief. Because you know, us alcoholics don't suffer well, do we? Thank God I got back in the program and working the steps. And got back in those 12 steps. Big turning point in my life. The sixth and the seventh steps are the least written in the big book about it, but they were the, man, the biggest steps in my life. Because it was that where I said, okay, God, here you go. If you think you can do something with all this mess, here it is, the good and the bad. You know, take away those defects that stand in the way of my usefulness. I wasn't useful. How are you useful rolling around in a parking lot fighting with an AA member? Take away the defects that stand in the way of my usefulness to my fellow man and to you. And it was the biggest turning point. And I moved on the steps. Because, see, I didn't think I needed to work the eighth and ninth step. Because this was my war cry as an alcoholic. And I'm sure some of you too. I'm only hurting me. Just let me drink. I'm only hurting me. That was my war cry. I guess that helped me live in my own skin. But as a result of working the steps and having to get honest, and like the book says, I was like a tornado roaring through everybody's life that cared about me, every life I touched. How could I even live in the delusion that I was only hurting me? I don't know. Because, you know, my mom, she stuck by me through every bit of that. Every bit of it. And when I used to be standing in those courtrooms, and that judge would be sentencing me to 10 years in the penitentiary, and I would be looking at him with all the hate that was in me, I could hear my mama screaming and crying behind me. Because that was her baby girl going to the penitentiary. She came to that prison every Sunday. She cried when she came, and she cried when she left. But I'm only hurting me. You know, my grandmother, she's 88, and God's blessed me with these 10 years sobriety with her. And I'm her only granddaughter, and she worships the ground I walk on. the delusion, I'm only hurting me. You know, I was in her house one day and I was robbing her house, robbing anything I could get to get that next drink. And I knocked her table over and her family Bible fell over and little pieces of paper came out of her Bible. And I started picking them up and reading them. And every one of them was prayers for me. Preacher told her if she would put her prayers in her favorite verse, God would hear them. I was robbing her house. But I'm only hurting me. You know, somebody asked me one day, they said, you know, Tammy, when you talk about that and you have so much emotion, are you living in the past? And I went, no. These are tears of gratitude that I don't have to be that person anymore. I don't have to live like that anymore. You know, today I can be a daughter and I can be a granddaughter. And it's all as a result of the 12 steps, Alcoholics Anonymous. I have one brother, and he's an attorney today. Yes, I have a resentment about that because he got his law degree after I got sober. I'm like, God, all them years, you know? And my parents bought a bar after I got sober. And I'm like, you talking about resentments? You know, I needed them to have a bar back then. But my little brother, he's always worshiped the ground I walk on. You know, and you talk about going through that eighth and ninth step. And, you know, my grandfather, he was his favorite. And he left him everything when he passed away. And he didn't have much. He left my little brother rifles, coin collections. I stole every bit of that stuff and sold it probably for a bottle of wine. And it wasn't worth no money. And so you talk about making amends. How do you amend some of this stuff? I don't know. But I've went and I've done what the book says. And I try to be that daughter and that sister and make the living amends. And the book says we have a long road of reconstruction ahead. And it'll be a lifetime of reconstruction for me. But I know today I have a good relationship with them all. My dad's came back in my life and he lives not far, and I always forget to bring him up later in my story. I just kind of leave him as a Harley-riding, dope-dealing. He heard my tape one time. He got a little resentment about that, but he's doing okay. I mean, he probably needs to be here with us, but that's his business. So many things have happened in my life, so many things. You know, I went back to school. You know how we are. I went back to school when I got sober, and that's another God thing, and I don't have too much time left, but there's a few more things I want to share with you. I went back to school, and I got my bachelor's degree. And, you know, I dropped out of school in the eighth grade. I took my GED and the state penitentiary. And you people told me, with God, all things are possible. Shoot for the moon, Tammy. Just keep your feet on the ground. You know, keep your AA first in your life. You can do and be anything you want to be. Thank y'all for telling me that. Because do you really think an eighth grade dropout, GED at Julia Tutwiler Prison, really thought they could go to college? But I got shuffled around one day in registration. I really went down there to put a con job on a financial aid deal they had on TV. And I got shuffled around before you know I'm standing in front of this lady. And she said, what class you want to take? I said, look, lady, I just want to see about getting that money that y'all had the commercial, blah, blah. And she said, well, go on and sign up for a class and you can get your money next week at the financial aid office. She said, how about history? I said, well, I guess history's all right, you know. I get back in my car, and I'm sitting there about teared up, about to cry, like, I got to start school tomorrow. I don't even have a piece of paper or a pencil, you know. And I don't even know who discovered America, and I got to take college history. But I made a C in that class. But let me tell you, when I go to registration, I'd be like, no, can't tell you, that's my meeting night. That's my meeting night. Then people be looking at me like, do you want to go to school or not? But it always worked out. My AA was first. But anyway, I went back to school and I got my degree. And you talk about just some little things you can do to make amends. You know, when I graduated in 96 with my bachelor's degree, and I walked that night in that stupid cap and thing and gown and heels, and I couldn't even walk in heels and a dress and all that, I didn't do it for me. You know, I did it for my mom. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous finally made me make her a proud mother. I never could do that before. And she was the proudest mother in that place that night. I was waiting any minute for her to have pom-poms and do a cheer or something. Those are some of the little things. You know, I'm able to go over at my grandmother's and eat with her every Sunday. And sometimes even go to the Baptist church with her. And I go eat with her every Sunday. And as you can tell, she cooks some good biscuits. And I'm able to take her all up through Pickens County 3 times a year and put flowers on the grave. And I mean, I get the long lecture when I've got to put her flowers on the grave and what color and what time of year. And I couldn't have done that drunk. I would have, you know, can you imagine? All through Pickens County, but sobriety has gave me that opportunity to be a granddaughter. My brother, me and him are just like this, you know. And so AA's been good to me. Another thing that happened was I was able to go back in that prison, and I carried an AA meeting in that prison to those women for 6 years. And I was able to tell them, you don't have to live like this anymore. There's a way out. And I was able to hold my head up high and not feel better or less than anybody in there. And one of the nicest things that was ever said about me, to me, whatever, was said by one of them convicts right there at that prison. I listened to a lot of speaker tapes, and Johnny H. is one of my heroes in AA, and he used to tell this story how when he was in prison, how committed and dedicated the Alcoholics Anonymous people were, and they were going to be there every week no matter what. And he said one night there was a blizzard and the road was closed for 20 miles. And he was the chairperson, you know, he was a convict in there. And the guard said, Johnny, the AA people are not coming tonight. There's a blizzard. The roads are closed. Johnny said, yeah, that AA man will be here. He believed in him that much. A few minutes later, they heard a bell and here came the AA man on a horse and sleigh to bring the AA meeting in there. And I used to hear him tell that story and I'd just get chills. One night, there was a tornado in Wetumpka, and my inmate, the chair of the meeting, was waiting on me. And the guard told her, said, Tammy's not coming tonight. A tornado just hit down 5 miles from here. And that inmate said, no, Tammy will be here. And she believed in my commitment to Alcoholics Anonymous that much that she knew I would be there that night for that meeting. And sure enough, here I came, got my car umbrella turned inside out, you know. The inmates were in a tornado drill. I had to go in the shower area with them, 200 inmates. I had a big book. We had a meeting. Hey, it turned out good. So many things. You know, I you people told me. You taught me everything I knew about living. You said, Tammy, get a job. You're an AA bum. So I said, okay, because see, I had never worked a day in my life. The only time I ever worked was in that prison. They made you work. So I said, yeah, I'll get a job. So I went everywhere and put an application in that I knew they'd never hire me. Banks, Department of Revenue. And I'd fill out that application and say, you ever been convicted of a felony? And I'd say, yes, additional pages attached. And I'd list everything I'd ever done. Well, let me tell you, the state of Alabama Department of Revenue gave me a job. That tells you a lot about our state. So I went to work there, and that was the first job I ever had. And I was going to school during that time and working too. And you know, these little ladies, I worked in a department with like 80 women, and my big boss that hired me said, Tammy, you really don't need to share with all these women about your past. Just keep it to yourself and just, you know. So I never told them. You know, I never told them anything about me, and we just worked. After 4 years, and I graduated, and I was getting another job, you know, they gave me a little party, a going-away party. And those little ladies cried because I was leaving. You know, they didn't know anything about me. And this was my first job I'd ever had in my life. The only thing that, you know, every day we'd walk to the parking lot together. And in Alabama, down at the state offices, they let the inmates come out in whites and work down there, some of them, on minimum out. And every day when we'd be walking the parking lot, the big blue bus with all the women would come around the corner, and all the inmates would be out the window, "Hey, Tammy," you know. And those little ladies never asked any questions about that, and I never told them. But they loved me that much. They gave me that party and gifts and everything. And I went to work with DHR, and I worked there as a social worker for a while. And then my counselor called me from Tutwiler and asked me would I come back to work, come for an interview at the prison. And I was like, oh, I don't know about this. And so I went up there for an interview, and they hired me. And I went to work in that same prison that I'd been in all my life. I said, you know, God's got a sense of humor. I'm going to do a life sentence before it's over with, you know. And I worked there for 3 years, and it was a great opportunity. And a lot of women that I see in meetings today, and that's a big blessing. But treatment wasn't for me. It just wasn't for me working in that field. And my hat's off to anybody that can do it, because we need you. I just couldn't do it. It was affecting my AA program. So I just started praying, God, I said if it ever affected my AA program, I'd quit. And, you know, this job I have now just kind of fell in my lap, literally. And today I'm a trainer, and I train social workers with DHR about substance abuse and alcoholism and the effects on the family. And I love this job. I still feel like I'm able to help people. I'm just not having to work directly with alcoholics. So what a blessing. And, you know, it's just there's so many things. You know, I continue to work steps 10 and 11 and continue to seek through prayer and meditation. And I guess the most important thing in my life today is that big hole. Us alcoholics know it. That big hole in my gut that only alcohol could barely touch is filled today. You know, I have God in my life, and I never thought that was possible. I never thought it was possible. My grandmother, you know, she's a Southern Baptist, and her and God are just like this, you know. And she tells me, and I'm not a real religious person, but, you know, who knows what will happen one day. But she tells me that when we die and meet our Maker, that He's going to have one question for us. And it's going to be, how well have you served me? And if that's the question, then me and God are going to be okay. Because as a result of these 12 steps and having this spiritual awakening and carrying this message to His kids, His little alcoholic and addict kids, you know, I have a purpose today, and I am useful, and I am serving God. You know, I could go on and on about service work, sponsoring people. They, you know, if nothing else, they keep me entertained, you know? And I'll tell you just a couple things, and I know my time is almost up, but you know how when you're growing up and you're putting your mother through everything, and she says, when you have kids, they're going to put you through the same thing. Well, I don't have children, but it's came back around to me in AA. Because I'm going to tell you, the women that attract to me and want me to sponsor them, and Judy will tell you this, she won't even go some places with them because some of them are so socially retarded, you have to kind of start them off at Burger King before you can take them to other restaurants, you know. But anyway, you talk about it coming around, and I'm sponsoring this one. She's only been out of prison a couple months, and we're sitting out there the other night. And, I mean, she's carrying, I mean, she just dabs around, waiting any minute for her to slice somebody's throat in there. And we're sitting out there, and she says, if she looks at me one more time, I'm going to cut her throat. And I was just like, okay, let's pray. Let's just pray together. Don't cut her. And I just had to laugh because I thought about my mother telling me that and how it's coming back around in sponsorship, you know. And I did. I prayed with her. And I had another one, and she can say the F word more than anybody I've ever seen in one sentence. One sentence, she used the F word five times. I'm like, God, that's so creative. And she had to speak one night at a group. And I mean, literally, we prayed when we left the house. I stopped four times on the way to that group and we prayed. And we are praying for her not to say that word when she spoke, you know. And she didn't say it one time. She did say the other little words, but they're not as bad as that word. So, you know, sponsorship, you know, and just being able to carry this message. And, you know, I've been a GSR, and, my sponsor wouldn't let me go to district for 5 years because I didn't argue well. And, you know, she didn't want me down there, you know, pulling my switchblade at area assembly and district and all that. So I had 5 years before she would even let me go to district. And I have been the GSR, and Judy and I, Judy's the district treatment committee, and I'm the group representative, and so now we're involved in treatment, and I had to get out of corrections for a while, but so many things. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank y'all for this life. I know I'm a baby in this program, but there is nobody that loves Alcoholics Anonymous more than me, and I try to practice these principles in all my affairs. I try. And I love to help other alcoholics. You know, on and on and on and on, the blessings. You know, I have a car with a windshield in it today, you know. I don't know if you've ever drove a car without a windshield. I got a pardon, a full pardon from the state of Alabama. You told me to go get that. You told me to do that. Make amends to society. When I went and applied for that pardon, they said, you need one in Georgia, Tammy. I was one of them drunks. I took a drink. I moved around a lot. So I got a pardon from that state. I was able to vote last year, first time in my life. I was so excited in there. Oh, I'm voting. And everybody's looking at me like, this is not exciting, okay? But anyway, my time's up. I love y'all. Thank you for inviting us. I want to close with this one prayer, and one of my teachers used to say it. And it's, God, I know I'm not what I should be. And God, I know I'm not what I could be. But thank you, God, I'm not what I used to be. Thank y'all. Thank you, Milton.